This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 5:05 p.m. and in story one, we're going to take a look at some of the headlines that have been making the news yesterday and today. This one's a great one. I'm not usually fond when they start Indianifying places. I was very upset.
Did you make that word up?
I did.
Is that an Umapagan original, Indianifying?
Yes, I was very upset with what they did with Brickfields.
Yes.
I thought it kind of took away from a lot of the original charm that was there by putting up these fake lampposts and purple tiles.
I think it's a little more like the Disneyfication of what Indianness looks like.
Correct.
Yeah, you know, everything's just really clean and, you know, everything's pastel toned, everything's lovely, and it takes away a lot from what it used to look like. It's almost as if the original didn't matter.
That being said, the Batu Caves Temple has just received a new paint job.
So that was taped from this year's Taipusam celebration at Batu Caves. And what we're referring to with the paint job and with all the colour is that the 272-step stairs leading up to the entrance of the Sri Subramania Swami Temple has been painted with various bright hues of red, blue, yellow, green and orange. So it's now got this whole rainbow look.
Batu Caves is now Insta-worthy.
You know, it always was.
It always was.
It's just that now it's more sort of, you know, Insta-worthy according to modern sensibilities. Who doesn't love colour?
According to hipsters, right? Mm. Now, the new look has received praise online. Shamla Ganesan, one of BFM's producers, was actually there this past weekend. And here's what she thought about the stairs.
Well, I was actually at Batu Caves on Sunday morning because a friend of mine was visiting from UK and it was one of the sites that she wanted to visit. And we had no idea that they had started these works. But once we got there, we realized that it was part of the, I suppose, the refurbishment of the temple. I think they're doing the temple's consecration ceremony, which happens once every 12 years. And so it was really kind of a nice surprise to walk in and see the stairs being painted. They hadn't actually completely finished it because this was still Sunday morning. So I was quite surprised that by the end of Sunday, all these pictures were up everywhere on social media because they had completed it so fast. I must say that it looks really beautiful and it just adds like an element of fun because we've been seeing all of these people now posing in front of the stairs and it just, I guess, in a way makes the climb also a little bit more, I mean, if you're not there for just praying or for the religious experience, it kind of adds an element of fun and Instagram worthiness to the experience.
That is correct. Apparently, this new paint job is part of refurbishment efforts that have been going on for about a year and a half. So what Shamla Singh was absolutely right. When a temple is going through its consecration ceremony, they usually spend a few years refurbishing it up, lacing things with gold, making it look incredibly grand.
I'm really excited to see what else comes their way. I mean, considering that this is one of the things that they've done and it's made such a splash. I wonder what's next.
Yeah, but no, it looks good lah.
It does.
Right?
It's really pretty. It just makes you happy to look at, I think.
Exactly. Our next story actually is taking a look at China and how they're planning to scrap their two-child policy ending nearly 40 years of limits.
From great-great-grandmother down through five generations, this family is a perfect example of China's population crisis. There's only one great-great-grandchild.
So that was back when they were, you know, going with a one-child policy,
yeah,
which has been controversial for quite some time. Their birth restrictions have moved on from the one-child policy to a two-child policy in 2016. And that is basically happening because, just like with many other countries in the world, birth rates are falling.
Yeah, that's right. Chinese couples are still limited to two childs at present. Now, what's happening is officials are poised to enact a wide-ranging civil code that would end this policy that has actually been enforced through fines, but also notorious for cases of forced abortions and sterilization in the world's most populous country.
It's a story of pain and loss that could be told at hundreds of millions of dinner tables. I did fall pregnant for a second time, Jiang Xinping tells me, but I had an abortion.
Did you have a choice?
I couldn't keep it, she replies. You either go willingly or the government comes for you.
There's been a lot written, a lot documented about the restrictions, right, about the family planning policy in China. And there is a long history of it. Here's some history of their family planning policies and why they're now considering moving away from it specifically. This is audio from a news show, Good Morning Europe, with Soraya Lenny.
The one-child policy came into effect in the 1970s. As you say, in late 2015, early 2016, that was amended to the two-child policy because it has, even though it's the most populous nation on earth, it has an ageing population, which for long-term economic growth is a bad thing. Of course, you need a young workforce, you need capital contributions, so on and so forth. And the Chinese were finding that they were really in a bind when it comes to these sorts of issues. However, removing the one-child policy and then increasing that number to two hasn't really worked out the way they thought. The number of people having children was half of what they expected. There was not the baby boom they thought they would be having. So perhaps removing any kind of restrictions in general, they're hoping that this will be a lot more beneficial. There's also talk.
Right. So what's interesting about, I guess, removing this family planning policy is that people had speculated this might happen because there was a postage stamp. This is a great story.
I love this. Apparently, a postage stamp for the Year of the Pig in 2019 showing a little porcine family complete with three piglets. Not one.
Symbolism.
Not two. Three. Like the story.
Because the government controls everything, so every little thing matters.
You know what, though? I'm really interested to see how this affects China's gender imbalance, because for some time now, they've had a lot more men than they've had women.
Because it's not just one child. They had an anti-girl policy as well.
Pretty much. But that anti-girl policy is cultural as much as it is anything else.
Yes.
So people have been trying for sons specifically, and now that they no longer have this limit, I'm wondering how that will affect sons and daughters, because daughters in China are still regarded as sort of, well, eventually you're going to go off to another family, you know, you're still considered not exactly a drain on the resources, but it's, I don't know, there's a very interesting relationship between gender and family when it comes to how things go in China.
Yeah, they're still going to be drafting this new code. It's not something you're going to see possibly until about 2020.
Mm.
That being said, if you were interested in more information, there is a fantastic book by Mei Feng called China's One-Child Policy. And she is a Malaysian who lives in the United States, and she's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. And it's a very comprehensive study on the the history and legacy of this policy. So you can check that out if you're interested.
It's been a very damaging policy overall, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I understand why they needed it, but yeah, they're seeing the effects of it now.
Our next story is going to take us to Myanmar, where we're going to look at the Rohingya community.
My name is Asmatullah. I fled from Myanmar to Bangladesh. When I left from my house at that time, Myanmar government surrounded our villages. They start a gunshot. Myanmar government forces slaughtered our Rohingya Muslim people. My brother was shot dead by Myanmar government eyewitness.
That was clips. That was taken actually from a bunch of video interviews that The Guardian did with Rohingya refugees and talking about the kinds of, the situations that they faced when they were leaving their villages.
Yeah, so a UN report has called for Myanmar's military to be investigated for genocide and crimes against humanity across the country, right? Some of the crimes listed in the report were indiscriminate killing, assault towards children, burning of villages, sexual violence, enslavement. The list really just goes on and on. It also found evidence of mass extermination and deportation in the northern Rakhine state.
Over the past year, there have been an estimated 25,000 people who've been killed. 70,000 people have fled over the border to Bangladesh. But Myanmar has rejected the report. And I do want to say that it's interesting because my father was traveling between KL and Yangon for a time. And when he came back, we had conversations about this, and he basically spouted what I suppose is the government line. He said, well, you know, they're terrorists. You don't understand until you go there and you listen to how local Burmese people talk about them. And I was kind of shocked by that. But it really does reflect, I think, what level of news or what kind of discourse is being had in the country. There's no reason, I suppose, to have sympathy, unfortunately.
Well, no.
From within.
Not if the message you're getting, not if the propaganda that's being spewed is one-sided and painting these individuals in that way, you eventually, I mean, it's the oldest trick in the book, isn't it, when it comes to tarring an entire race of individuals.
That's right. We saw
it happen even in Sri Lanka as well. It was interesting. There was no nuance to the conversation on the Sinhalese side because for the longest time, because before the internet and all of that stuff, you essentially had only one source of information.
And even now with the internet, these reports tend to be run by international organizations like the UN, and it's quite natural for somebody to feel, well, what do you know about my country? Who are you to come in and make these reports? Having said that, the report did name six senior military figures that it believes should go on trial. And it also criticized Myanmar's de facto leader, Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi, for failing to intervene to stop the attacks.
Yeah, so, I mean, Aung San Suu Kyi has come under a lot of pressure and criticism. We have audio of her speech from last year in September, where she finally broke her silence on the Rohingya crisis. This speech brought quite a bit of criticism over alleged falsehoods and her ongoing reluctance to address the issue.
I'm aware of the fact this attention is focused on the situation in Rakhine State. And as I said at the General Assembly last year, as a responsible member of the community of nations, Myanmar does not fear international scrutiny. It is not the intention of the Myanmar government to apportion blame or to abnegate responsibility. We condemn all human rights violations and unlawful violence. We are committed to the restoration of peace, stability and rule of law throughout the state. I think it is very little known that the great majority of Muslims in the Rakhine State have not joined the exodus. More than 50% of the villages of Muslims are intact. They are as they were before the attacks took place. I understand that many of our friends throughout the world are concerned by reports of villages been burned and of hordes of refugees fleeing. We too are concerned. We want to find out what the real problems are. There have been allegations and counter-allegations, and we have to listen to all of them. And we have to make sure that these allegations are based on solid evidence before we take action. Action will be taken against all peoples, regardless of their religion, race, or political position, who go against the laws of the land and who violate human rights as accepted by our international community.
So once again, I suppose this UN report is directly contradicting most of what she had said in that speech.
Yeah.
They're also calling for the International Criminal Court to investigate the violence. And the ICC, in turn, is deliberating on whether or not they can do that because Myanmar is not a signatory to the Rome Statute and therefore not under the court's jurisdiction.
Yeah, the report also said that with Myanmar's repeated failure to admit to the genocide and also with the legal impunity given to the military, it's the responsibility of the international community to hold the perpetrators to account. And I think
this sounds like a dead end. I don't know. It sounded good, you know, the headline sounds great, but when you kind of delve into it, I don't know what's going to be done.
I don't think anything's going to be done. At least unless it comes from within, right? I mean, therein lies the problem. The international community can speak out the way it is, the way it has been. I don't think ASEAN is going to do anything. Their non-interference policy prevents them from doing more than just giving them friendly advice. And so for the most part, I think this change has to come from within. And unfortunately, the person that the world has been relying on, Aung San Suu Kyi, to be this beacon of, I guess, reason and honesty and liberalism is failing in that job. So I don't know what's going to happen.
So, great start to our Tuesday, everybody.
Thank you. Sorry.
We're sorry about this. Yeah.
You know what will cheer you up? So, those are some Leon Bridges after these messages with Smooth Sailing on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.